Chapter 8. I hardly noticed the passage of the weeks as I rattled along the moorland roads on my daily rounds. But the district was beginning to take shape, the people to emerge as separate personalities. Most days, I had a puncture. The tyres were through to the canvas on all wheels. It surprised me that they took me anywhere at all. One of the few refinements on the car was a rusty sunshine roof. It grated dismally when I slid it back, but most of the time I kept it open, and the windows too, and I drove in my shirt sleeves with the delicious air swirling about me. On wet days it didn't help much to close the roof because the rain dripped through the joints and formed pools on my lap and the passenger seat. I developed great skill in zigzagging round puddles. To drive through was a mistake, as the muddy water fountained up through the gaps in the floorboards. But it was a fine summer, and long days in the open gave me a tan which rivaled the farmer's. Even mending a puncture was no penance on the high, unfenced roads, with the wheeling curlews for company and the wind bringing the scents of flowers and trees up from the valleys. And I could find other excuses to get out and sit on the crisp grass and look out over the airy roof of Yorkshire. It was like taking time out of life. Time to get things into perspective and assess my progress. Everything was so different that it confused me. This countryside, after years of city streets, the sense of release from exams and study, the job with its daily challenge. And then there was my boss. Siegfried Farnan charged round the practice with fierce energy from dawn till dark, and I often wondered what drove him on. It wasn't money, because he treated that with scant respect. When the bills were paid, the cash went into the pint pot on the mantelpiece, and he grabbed handfuls when he wanted it. I never saw him take out a wallet, but his pockets bulged with loose silver and balled-up notes. When he pulled out a thermometer, they flew around him in a cloud. After a week or two of headlong rush, he would disappear, maybe for the evening, maybe overnight, and often without saying where he was going. Mrs. Hall would serve a meal for two, but when she saw I was eating alone, she would remove the food without comment. He dashed off the list of calls each morning with such speed that I was quite often sent hurrying off to the wrong farm, or to do the wrong thing. When I told him later of my embarrassment, he would laugh heartily. There was one time when he got involved himself. I had just taken a call from a Mr. Heaton of Bronsett about doing a post-mortem on a dead sheep. "I'd like you to come with me, James," Siegfried said. "Things are quiet this morning, and I believe they teach you blokes a pretty hot post-mortem procedure. I want to see you in action." We drove into the village of Bronsett, and Siegfried swung the car left into a gated lane. "Where are you going?" I said. "Heaton's is at the other end of the village."
"But you said Seaton's."
"No, I assure you. Look, James, I was right by you when you were talking to the man. I distinctly heard you say the name." I opened my mouth to argue further, but the car was hurtling down the lane, and Siegfried's jaw was jutting. I decided to let him find out for himself. We arrived outside the farmhouse with a screaming of brakes. Siegfried had left his seat and was rummaging in the boot before the car had stopped shuddering.
"Oh, hell!" he shouted. "No post-mortem knife, never mind. I'll borrow something from the house."
He slammed down the lid and bustled over to the door. The farmer's wife answered, and Siegfried beamed on her.
"Good morning to you, Mrs. Seaton. Have you a carving knife?"
The good lady raised her eyebrows. "What was that you said?"
"A carving knife, Mrs. Seaton. A carving knife, and a good sharp one, please."
"You want a carving knife?"
"Yes, that's right. A carving knife," Siegfried cried, his scanty store of patience beginning to run out. "And I wonder if you'd mind hurrying. I haven't much time."
The bewildered woman withdrew to the kitchen, and I could hear whispering and muttering. Children's heads peeped out at intervals to get a quick look at Siegfried stamping irritably on the step. After some delay, one of the daughters advanced timidly, holding out a long, dangerous-looking knife. Siegfried snatched it from her hand and ran his thumb up and down the edge.
"This is no damn good," he shouted in exasperation. "Don't you understand? I want something really sharp. Fetch me a steel."
The girl fled back into the kitchen, and there was a low rumble of voices. It was some minutes before another young girl was pushed round the door. She inched her way up to Siegfried, gave him the steel at arm's length, and dashed back to safety. Siegfried prided himself on his skill at sharpening a knife. It was something he enjoyed doing. As he stropped the knife on the steel, he warmed to his work and finally burst into song. There was no sound from the kitchen, only the ring of steel on steel backed by the tuneless singing. There were silent intervals when he carefully tested the edge, then the noise would start again. When he had completed the job to his satisfaction, he appeared inside the door.
"Where is your husband?"
he called. There was no reply, so he strode into the kitchen, waving the gleaming blade in front of him. I followed him and saw Mrs. Seaton and her daughters cowering in the far corner, staring at Siegfried with large, frightened eyes. He made a sweeping gesture at them with a knife.
"Well, come on, I can get started now."
"Started what?" the mother whispered, holding her family close to her.
"I want to post-mortem this sheep. You have a dead sheep, haven't you?"
Explanations and apologies followed. Later, Siegfried remonstrated gravely with me for sending him to the wrong farm.
"You'll have to be a bit more careful in future, James," he said seriously. "Creates a very bad impression, that sort of thing."